Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
Who took the bomb?
You are listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with author Aaron Osman about Jason Molina and the music he made as Songs Ohio and Magnolia Electric Company. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. We'll also hear from Leon Bridges about the song that got him hooked on Sonics. But first, some new music. That is a little bit of the song Black Like Me by Mickey Guyton. It was a big single, Greg, in 2020 in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests. Guyton had put out several EPs. That was on one of them. And now we have her first full album for Capitol Records Nashville, Remember Her Name. Candace Michal Guyton, born 1983 in Arlington, Texas, spent a lot of her early years moving around the country with her dad, who was an engineer, but music was a constant. You know, she was singing in the church choir at age five. She was always loving sounds from across the genre spectrum. Dolly Parton and Leanne Rimes, you can hear both of those influences on her country tunes, but also Whitney Houston and the Winans. Really flexible vocal style, which she began honing when she moved to California and then eventually relocated in Nashville. There's a lot of anticipation for this album based on the buzz that was building from her EPs. What is she giving us on this record, Remember Her Name? We're going to play a track. We will come back and give our opinions. This is the song All American by Mickey Guyton on Sound Opinions.
We're the night shift, smoke break, high school heartache, driving with the windows down. We're the dance floors, church pews, suit and ties, tattoos, one big small town.
That is All American from Mickey Guyton, the debut album, Remember Her Name. It's interesting, debut album, age 38. She's been signed to Capitol Records in Nashville for 10 years before her debut studio album came out. You'd mentioned the EPs, Jim. She was kind of part of that Nashville assembly line for a number of years. Remember that in Nashville, it is kind of a closed door to black artists. I mean, you could name them on one hand that have had some success. Charlie Pride is probably the most famous. Darius Rucker had some success there after Hootie and the Blowfish. There's an artist named King
My
Brown.
Close personal friend, yes. Darius Rucker, yes.
But even fewer black female artists in Nashville. I can't think of too many after, you know, in recent years, let alone throughout the history of the genre. So she was knocking at the door trying to play the game. And then, you know, when Black Like Me came out, she wrote that song Black Like Me and became a viral hit. Country radio avoided it. That sort of signaled that something was happening here. There was a buzz building, as you said, about her, specifically tied to that song. That's on this record. All American, the song we just played, may be the first Nashville country song to mention both James Brown and Dookie Braids. I can't think of too many that have done that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Again, she's sort of subverting from within. At the same time, that's a song that, you know, has that banjo plucking away, and it's the kind of production that you would expect of a country song. Lyrically, you know, she's going for it. I mean, she's black like me. If you think we live in the land of the free, you should try to be black like me. You know, you also have songs like Love My Hair, the things I did to try to fit right in. I'll never justify my skin again. She's talking about her identity as a woman who has been you know, racial profiling, stereotyping. You know, how do you fit in an all-white kind of town? You know, supporting a genre of music that has been dominated by white males. You know, it's tough as a female white artist to get on country radio again. Yeah. Black female artists, well,
especially,
you know, the odds are really stacked
against
you.
Especially if you're offering any measure of social commentary, witness the Dixie Chicks.
So, you know, Mickey Guyton, I think, is an important artist. She's got a terrific voice, supple, powerful, some gospel background in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I am disappointed in the production on this record.
I was waiting for you to get there.
I was just like, wow. I mean, talk about, you know, to me it's like, okay, she's trying to get on the radio, craft songs that will get played on Nashville or country radio, but subverting from within with these kind of with these lyrics.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, there are artists out there who are breaking barriers, you know, from a production standpoint. Margot Price, Casey Musgraves, Brandi Carlile, Maren Morris. I was hoping Mickey would go more in that direction, but she's still playing it safe on the production side.
When you read that she was disappointed in some of the Nashville pop hit factory productions of her earlier EPs, you would think, all right, yeah, Now's her chance. And she blows it, Greg. And I think as a woman of color breaking down doors, of course we applaud that. You know, Greg, look at some truly revolutionary artists who are breaking ground sonically as well as lyrically. We've recently reviewed Amethyst Kia and Adia Victoria and Little Nas X. Mm-hmm. All right, that's as big as a left field country hit could ever possibly get. And Mickey Guyton, I mean, look at the song Rosé. All right.
Yeah.
This is as bad a song as I've heard, like ever. All right. This is going on my all-time worst songs list.
Rosé.
You know, she just thinks pink when she orders a drink, and you know, rhymes a sommelier with bourgeoisie. I don't know quite how that works.
Yeah.
Rosé. I mean, this is a female attempt to score a hit like freaking Toby Keith's Red Solo Cup.
Yeah, right.
It's just dreadful. You know, and dancing in the living room is just pop dreck. Said you liked Love My Hair. I wish she was digging deeper. You read the second half of those powerful lines, Black Like Me. If you think we live in the land of the free, you should try being black like me. But the first half, white picket fences as far as you can see. Come on. Come on. This is what it's like on Easy Street. Give me a break. You know, it's a transparent attempt to try to break down those borders in Nashville that should not exist, that need breaking down. I just wish I was just so disappointed. And every time I listened to this album, it made me more angry because that voice is powerful. She deserves better.
She does indeed. Both of us disappointed in the Mickey Guyton record, despite a great deal of promise. And we hope that Mickey at some point will be able to realize that. But we want to hear from our listeners. Mickey Guyton's making a lot of noise. What do you think about her? Leave us a voice message with your thoughts on our website, soundopinions.org. Next, we've got a conversation with Erin Osman on her biography of Jason Molina. That's next on Sound Opinions.
I've been riding with the ghost. I've been
welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. That is a little bit of the song I've Been Writing with the Ghost by Jason Molina under the band name Songs Ahia from the album Magnolia Electric Company, which came before he started Magnolia Electric Company, the band. It all gets a little confusing. Riding with the Ghost, however, is also the title of Erin Osman's great book on Jason Molina's art and life. She explains it all. And that life was tragically cut short, Greg, at age 39 when Molina died in 2013.
Yeah, indeed. Erin's book is wonderful, Jim. And she really gives us a new appreciation for Jason's work that some of us, frankly, didn't have while he was alive. So it was great to talk with her.
We are late, Greg, but excited nonetheless to have Erin Osman on Sound Opinions to talk about her fantastic book about Jason Molina. I got a chance to blurb it. It broke my heart, Erin. You had tweeted, you know, I'm proud of my book, but I didn't get to be on Sound Opinions. So I'm like, oh, Greg, we got to rectify this because this is a fantastic book about a fascinating life and an interesting period in music history. And even though Greg and I are not huge fans of Jason Molina, we want to have you tell his story and introduce this amazing career. 16 studio albums in 17 years before an extremely untimely death. So thank you for coming on to talk about your Molina book.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Let's start at the very beginning. What made you a fan and what made you convinced that this was a biography worth tackling?
Sure. So I'm from Evansville, Indiana, which is in the southern part of the state. And we didn't have access to a lot of stuff there. We didn't have really a real record store. And so the byproduct of that was we developed a pretty small but vibrant music community where we traded tapes. If someone went out of town and went to a real record store and brought back the records, we'd trade them and make mixtapes. And that's kind of how we found music before the internet in a place that didn't have a lot of music. One day, a friend's brother came home from college with Jason's first record called The Black Album. And a song from that record made its way onto a mixtape that landed in my car. It was called Cowboy Lingo. And I was just enamored with this song. It was so mysterious and kind of spooky and lo-fi, like all these qualities that I love.
We are all, I think, things that troubling.
But it was a singer-songwriter. It was folk music. And at the time, I was heavily into punk rock. But just the fidelity of the recording and the quality of it made me realize that, like, punk and folk could go together, mm-hmm. you know? And from then on, I sort of followed what Jason did because I was just pretty enamored with this one song that ended up in my car in a tape. The other thing was that, you know, Jason is Midwestern. He's from a small town in Ohio. I'm from a small town in Indiana, and I think there's a lot of similar identity there and sort of province. And so that was really exciting for me, too, to see someone who was sort of like me making records.
Well, and you make the case that that upbringing, growing up in a trailer park, mm-hmm. you make the case that that, you know, echoes then throughout all the art he created.
Yeah, so Jason grew up in a single-wide trailer on the banks of Lake Erie in Lorain, Ohio, which is a small town in northern Ohio, obviously. And, you know, we have this idea of what a trailer park is, but where Jason grew up was really a little more beautiful and pastoral than that. I mean, I think there probably were some seedy elements around him, but he and his brother and sister had the run of the lake. You know, that they grew up fishing and swimming and, you know, they were like little Boy Scouts growing up.
Yeah.
And the other thing is they didn't have cable television or the internet. And so Jason really relied on his imagination and his very vibrant imagination to entertain himself. So they read a lot. They listened to their dad's records all the time. He and his brother Erin would pretend to sing like their favorite bands like Ozzy Osbourne and Led Zeppelin and things like that. They would mimic VHS tapes that they had. So it was really kind of a charming upbringing. But a lot of that kind of pastoral imagery and also the industrial imagery of the area shows up in Jason's music.
See the big city blue, between the radio tower. Between the big diesel rigs in the Midwest, switching out watch the whole town eclipsed.
Yeah, you mentioned too, I think it was Black Sabbath, right? Wasn't he at a cover band that they covered Black Sabbath songs?
Yeah, he loved Black Sabbath. Yeah. He loved Ozzy. He loved Black Sabbath. Jason started out as a bass player in kind of a punk metal band. Yeah, yeah. So that was his sort of origin. Yeah.
So how do you go from that to making these intimate bedroom type lo-fi folk records early in your career? That was quite a leap. What was the transition?
Definitely. It was when Jason began college at Oberlin College, which is like sort of this famous liberal arts college in Ohio. And for whatever reason, when he landed at Oberlin, he decided to transform. Maybe it was because his band members from high school weren't with him, right? So he was sort of alone. And he adopted the use of a tenor guitar, which makes sense because he was a bass player, you know, so four strings. And he just started writing these really Spartan, emotionally fueled, mysterious songs about the Civil War and about industrial landscapes. And it was really unique.
Tell all my friends that I'm bound for heaven. And if it ain't so, you can't blame me for living. I know what it's like, and it's worth this misfortune.
And he became the guy on campus who was marching around in a cowboy hat with a tenor guitar, just singing anywhere that would have him.
Huh, boy. That's kind of remarkable. You know, the whole thing, I think part of the mystique around Molina is that this guy's enigmatic. You're not really quite sure what he's singing about. There's a depth there that seems beyond the upbringing you're describing. So there must have been an interior world going on there that was maybe separate from what he was doing. But were you ever able to put your finger on it? I know you got to know his wife very well and a number of people around him. Do they have any insight into that interior world that he must have been living in to allow these songs to pop out when he started writing songs?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Greg. Jason had great interiority, right, that he broadcast through his music. And Jason was extremely studious. He read a lot. He studied everything that he could get his hands on. At one point, he and his brother were reading manuals for, like, typewriters for fun, you know? So he just absorbed a lot of information, and that was really important to him his entire life. He was a dedicated reader. The other thing is Jason was very romantic. He was romantic in love, so the women of his affections were doted on and adored, and that's just kind of a part of his personality. But he was romantic in the sense, too, that he was really what I think of as a true artist. He was constantly creating. He was actually an art major at Oberlin, so he was constantly drawing, painting, creating sculptures with found objects, and he would give them away to people. And part of that, I think, is he was developing sort of a personal mythology, like leaving these sort of talisman behind as he went through his life. But also it was sincere. Jason felt that like making something and giving it to someone was a really beautiful, profound, and romantic act, whether it was a friend or a fan or a loved one.
You know, you mentioned Oberlin, Aaron, and like all great biographies, your book tells many stories besides that of the subject. One of them is that fascinating period at Oberlin, which really echoed throughout the end of his life. I mean, he was continually going back to people, musicians he first met at Oberlin. They were all there. Another story you tell is that of the label Secretly Canadian. He made the label. The label made him. Talk about that.
Yeah. So Secretly Canadian now is obviously one of the biggest indie labels in the world, right? It's massive. But at the time that they signed Jason, they were nothing. They had just started. They had put out one CD by a songwriter called June Panic, and they were looking for their first really big thing to do. Mm-hmm. Chris Swanson, who's one of the co-founders of Secretly Canadian, had heard a song of Jason's through Drag City. Jason put out a single through Will Oldham's imprint of Drag City. Chris heard that and just fell in love with it. But he and the co-founders of the label thought that Jason was like this big rock star, right? Like, it was probably inaccessible. Like, why would he give them time of day, right? Yeah. So he tracked down Jason's email address. And to his surprise, Jason wrote back right away. It was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. But he issued Chris and Ben Swanson, the brothers of the label, the first in many tests. He was like, I'll do it, but you have to drive to New York to get the dats from
when,
me.
When they were based really close, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they could have got together for a beer, no problem.
Exactly.
Yeah. That story is fascinating because there is this ambivalence throughout his life. You know, he said as a kid, I want to be a rock star. He wanted to be a rock star. You know, he sees Nico Case having this luxe touring bus, you know, and he doesn't want to ride in a van anymore. You know, is it because he thinks he deserves better, or he wants to treat his bandmates better, or all of the above? But at the same time, he hates doing interviews, hates doing anything promotional, hates playing songs that people shout out, you know, that they love, that they've paid to come see him. Talk about that ambivalence. Where does this come from?
Yeah, Jason was really interesting in that respect. He definitely didn't like to be told what to do. That was not a part of his kind of being at the time. And yeah, he wanted to make art on his own terms. It was very much art for art's sake. That's why he made some of the like strange decisions that he did along the way that were like terribly unfashionable, right? But you're right. I mean, Jason loved the idea of touring, but the actual act of touring, I think he really didn't like it all. He liked to be comfortable, for one. He was a homebody when he was at home with his wife, and he liked to be comfortable, and the road is not comfortable. No. And he had a complicated relationship with his fans because Jason was always moving forward, right? He would record a record, and then that was ancient history, and he was on to the next thing. His mind was very active.
Well, the day it was finished, this is the best record I've ever made, and that lasted how long? Because you said he'd say that every time.
Yeah.
But it lasted like weeks, right?
Yeah. I mean, maybe a day, you know, he was on to the next thing. And that's a mark of a busy mind, right? Of someone who's really prolific, someone who makes art for art's sake, and who has an active imagination and mind and intellect.
Never forget, it was triumph we once proposed. Instead, you betrayed our mission for mission words.
People may not know Molina's name, but they know Songs Ohio and Magnolia Electric Company, his two bands. And it seemed like in some ways there was a certain interchangeability about them, but band members came and went. There were strange experiments where he would bring musicians into the room and none of them knew each other. And like, what are we doing here? And he would arrange the songs on the fly and come up with stuff. It had sort of a Dylan-esque quality to it. Like, I'm going to screw around with you a little bit before we make music just to see how you respond, to take you out of your comfort zone. That seemed like people wanted to work with this guy, right? I mean, it was like, and he put him in these strange situations. I mean, what was your sense of his collaborators? Did they enjoy these kind of games, or did they just kind of go with the flow?
You know, one thing about Jason is he loved to be the conductor of his friends. So a lot of these folks that are involved in Songs Ohio, especially, were old friends of his from Oberlin, who happened to move to Chicago all at the same time when Jason happened to move to Chicago. So it was a lot of those folks that Jason assembled to kind of be his band. And he loved that. He loved that spirit of community. But Jason also loved the spirit of live performance, right? He loved that moment when a song kind of tipped from chaos into something beautiful. I think his goal was always to capture that on his records rather than have something be super produced. But the ultimate example of that is Magnolia Electric Company, the album, which is the last album by Songs Ohio. And that's when Jason assembled this huge cast of friends and acquaintances at Steve Albini's studio there in Chicago and did exactly what you said. He gave them a couple of demos ahead of time that they could listen to. But when they got in there, he was really like, what do you want to bring to this song? Like, what makes you unique, and what can you add in terms of texture or layer? And that was just this lightning in a bottle moment for all of these people. I mean, we had Scout Niblett, who is this really kind of oblique punk singer, right? We have Lawrence Peters, who's an iconic Chicago country musician and a bartender at the Hideout. And we have his Oberlin crew. And all these people came together, having never really played together before, and made something that was unique to the group, but also very indicative of Jason's vision, which is like this grand spirit of live performance. And he loved that. I will try. Eventually, Jason just abandoned that project altogether and formed Magnolia Electric Company, the band. And with that, he went back to Bloomington, Indiana, where Secretly Canadian is located, and he just gathered some guys that he liked there. He was like, oh, I've seen your band. Want to be in my band? They were like, Jason Molina, amazing. You know, like, of course I'll be in your band. And that's just kind of how he did things. He was very spontaneous. I don't think he liked things to feel tired or rehearsed or done and done again. And that's how he lived his life. And that's how he made his work.
Aaron, he also had ghosts that haunted him throughout his life. Growing up in the trailer park, idyllic, but also hard scrabble.
Yeah.
You know, his family had alcoholism run through it. It seemed as if he was, you don't make the mistake of diagnosing him from the armchair, but he seemed to have bouts of depression or mania and depression, and he self-medicated. And this was a secret to so many people around him, even those collaborators, those musicians traveling with him, that it came as a shock when everything breaks down around about 2011, and he has several attempts going to rehab and dies, you know, in 2013, multiple organ failure, drank himself to death, essentially. And I, from the many people you interviewed, it seems like all of those people in his life were still struggling to understand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can attribute this to genetics. His mom and his brother both struggled with alcoholism. And his brother told me the most heartbreaking thing, which is, you know, my brother Jason had the kind of alcoholism that kills you. Right? And that is a pretty shocking thing to say about your family member. But yeah. I mean, it is what happened. But yeah, Jason, I think, was ashamed of his drinking. And so he did it in secret. Even in like recording sessions, he would disappear completely sober and come back, you know, unable to function. And it really was vexing to his band, the guys in Magnolia Electric Company, who were just kind of getting to know Jason. You know, they weren't old friends from way back. And so this was shocking to them. Like, what is going on with you, man? Like, I mean, they had no idea. And it took years for them to kind of figure out what Jason was doing. He was never open about the issue. He always tried to hide it. He hid it from his wife, Darcy. And yeah, it eventually killed him, and it's tragic and sad. But one thing I wanted to do with the book was sort of lay out Jason's journey with alcoholism, but not romanticize it, because I think that is so dangerous. And so a reaction I get from readers is like, you know, you didn't pull any punches. And I mean, that's true. You know, I wanted to lay out the really ugly truths about Jason's journey and not romanticize it and not try to attribute it to some artistic impulse. Right. It was real and it was ugly and it took his life. And it's tragic because he was 39 years old, you know, way too young.
Well, and that gives a, you know, like there's three meanings to the title, Jason Molina Riding with the Ghost. You know, obviously it's a song, a great song, but also, you know, this shadow followed him throughout his life. The way, you know, I always despise in rock history, whether it's Syd Barrett or Kurt Cobain, right? They were great despite these awful challenges in their life, not because of them. So let us not say on the pedestal he was great because he dragged himself to death, romantic myth. Nonsense. It's amazing how much music he created, the 16 studio albums. You can't even begin to count the EPs and the tapes and the live records, right? And then he still died with hundreds of songs. Because as you said, he wrote every day.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He treated it like a 9-to-5 job. That was kind of, you know, that's his working class background, right? Which he resented and sort of wore as a badge of honor at the same time. But yeah, Jason got up every day at the same time. He would sit down with a pencil and a dictionary and just write, just go. And he wasn't into heavy revision. He was very much into the spontaneous way of working. And so, yeah, he died with a giant archive of lyrics and demos that hopefully all of them will see release one day. I'm not for sure. But yeah, he worked really hard. I think, I don't remember the exact quote, but he told an interviewer one time, you know, I don't see why, you know, I'm not the guy taking out the trash. He's like, right, I could be that guy, you know, but instead I will respect my craft with that sort of dedication as the trash man. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because here he dies at 39, and it's not like his career was off the rails and like he couldn't, you know, he wasn't good anymore. People still loved his music. He was probably more popular than ever at a certain level. And these songs, I think one of the things that your book points out, because you know, Aaron, the last part of your book is a tough read, not because it's poorly written, but it's just such a tragic story to watch this person deteriorate. Meanwhile, there's all these songs pouring out, and there's a brooding, melancholy quality about a lot of his songs anyway. But at the same time, your book points out that there was kind of a kernel of hope in all of them. It was not like, I want to die. It was like, okay, I'm going through this hard time, but I'm going to get through it somehow. It didn't seem to, it almost contradicted what was happening in his personal life.
Yeah, I mean, Jason wrote sad songs. Like, objectively, that's true. We hear a lot of emotion and a lot of melancholy and a lot of sadness, and especially in the way that he sings. But for him, he found a lot of hope in that act. And I don't know if it had to do with the release of that energy from his body, you know, kind of releasing those ghosts that he rode with into song. But yeah, he didn't see himself as a tragic figure or a sad guy. And in fact, that wasn't the only aspect of his personality. Jason was hilarious. He was a goofball. He played pranks on his bandmates on tour. He was incredibly multitudinous, multifaceted guy. So yeah, I think that the act of making gave him a lot of hope, even though audiences interpreted a lot of his art as tragic or sad or melancholic.
While you was gone, you must have done a lot of favors. You got a whole lot of things I don't think that you could ever have paid for. While you've been busy crying about my past mistakes, I've been busy trying to make a change, and now I made the change.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Aaron Osman about the three different phases of Jason Molina's career. That's next on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. Let's talk about the way the art was perceived. Do you buy slowcore? There's a word thrown at him sometime, and you got to admit, you know, a huge part of that canon is mid to slow tempo. Where do you think he fits? I mean, he's coming from loving Hank Williams and the Carter family, but he also loves Peaches. He hates being compared to Will Oldham, but you know, there's a lot of Will Oldham in him, and a lot of him in Will Oldham. So, where do you think, as a critic, Aaron, that he fits?
Well, that's the fascinating thing about Jason is he changed over the years. He transformed into different iterations of Jason Molina, right? So he began as this renegade guy with a tenor guitar who was super mysterious and writing these oblique lyrics and singing in a bathroom, right? So that's the first two albums that Jason made. Then he kind of moved into the slowcore vibe. I do buy that. Jason was really into the band Codeine. Mm-hmm. He was a huge fan of Codeine. And so when we get into like The Lioness and albums like that, that's where we see more of the slowcore kind of quality of Jason's music. And it's really romantic and really beautiful, but slow moving and dirgy and sort of meditative. And then he makes an entirely different switch. When he gets to Chicago, he's really inspired by great Chicago figures, by the blues scene, kind of by some of the alt-country stuff that's happening at the time. And he switches to this complete, like, blues and Americana sort of focus with Didn't It Rain and the Magnolia Electric Company. And then moved in this into, like, a roots rock kind of template with his band Magnolia Electric Company. Yeah. So yeah, I think of his life in those kind of three phases. And that's unusual for an artist, but it wasn't unusual for Jason.
Well, all right, so you set us up perfectly, Aaron. three phases. Give us a song that you would, you know, because it's daunting. As with any catalog this extensive, right? Whether we're talking, I mean, you know, it's apples and kumquats, right? You know, whether it's Frank Zappa or the Mekons, where do you start, right? To the younger listener, right, who is inclined to dig, where do you send them to start? So let's take a song from each of those three phases that really moved you.
A song, okay. So I love the Black Album. It's his first album. It's the super lo-fi singer-songwriter with the tenor guitar and a tenor voice kind of vibe. But yeah, that song Cowboy Lingo, which is the first song on that record, that's the one that grabbed me in the 90s. So I recommend that to everyone because it's a great starting point and it shows where Jason started.
Against the smell of rope.
And then as we move on, when we get into his slowcore phase, I love the Linus album. It's because it's a really honest depiction of being in love, right? Like both the anxiety of being in love and the greatness of being in love. And I love that holistic picture that he painted. But there's a song on the Linus called, it breaks my heart. It's called The Black Crow. And it is the most heart-wrenching kind of musical journey. It's 7 minutes long. It's super dirgy and it goes in a lot of different directions. And the lyrics are so sad, but every time I listen to that song, it just really, I'm just really in awe of this period of Jason's work.
I'm getting weaker.
I love that song in particular, but people love the song Coxcomb Red from that album. The song Being in Love is tremendous. Glenn Hansard has covered that song before. And also The Lioness from that album is a great song. So that's kind of like the slowcore phase. And then when we get into like the more alt country or roots rock kind of phase, I mean, the album Magnolia Electric Company is considered Jason's magnum opus, right? It's the album that everyone loves. It's a great entry point for fans if you've never heard Jason's music before. It's really him at the height of his songwriting powers. And he's doing different things with his voice on this album. He's doing a little bit of like Warren Zevon style speak singing along with his really velvety romantic tenor singing. He knocked it out of the park with this one. So Farewell Transmission, I've Been Writing with the Ghost, Just Be Simple, Hold on Magnolia. These are all incredible songs from that album. And I would recommend any of them.
I've been riding with the ghost. I've been doing whatever he told me. I've been looking door to door to see if there was someone who'd hold me. Never met a single one who didn't see through me. None of them would love me if they thought they might lose me. Unless I made a change.
Yeah, now because it can be confusing. I was doing stuff around the house the other day, and I just put on the Spotify shuffle of everything. And it's like, it was overwhelming. I also found myself very sad after about 4 hours.
Yeah.
But I love the book, and you bring it up to the point of the influence he had. You mentioned Glenn Hansard. You know, Tweedy, Jeff Tweedy of Wilco was super impressed. Oldham and he had this almost competitive Lennon-McCartney thing going for a while. You know, there have been tribute albums. There are a bevy of artists covering him. It seems as if the influence is echoing and echoing.
Jason's death was tragic, but it did one thing, which is it drew an entirely new audience to his story and his music in the wake of the tragedy, right? We have people like Amanda Shires covering Just Be Simple.
My whole life has been about trying, 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 trying to just be simple again.
It's pretty incredible. By the end of Jason's life and career, he did have a really strong fan base, and he almost developed sort of a Grateful Dead style thing where people would follow the band from gig to gig, which is kind of cool. Mm. But Jason had also sort of worn people out. He toured a lot. He had released a lot of music. He had sort of an acrimonious relationship with the press. And so I don't think he was getting as much attention as he probably should have, particularly in the press. And so, you know, his tragic death sort of caused both, you know, music critics and the music industry, but also fans, old and new, to reevaluate their relationship with Jason and his life and his tremendous body of work. So yeah, for me, it's been really exciting and wonderful to see all of the tributes, to see all of the new fans and the people that are discovering him. And, you know, people always tag me in their tweets, which is really fun for me personally.
Yeah.
Well, your book was a big part of that, you know, reassessment of, you know, Jason Molina. Don't underestimate your impact. You know, I think that's been an important part of, and to have his life so well described. So that's important. And the fact that you thought his life was worth exploring in such depth, do you think it's kind of a generational thing? I mean, it's your generation's music, right? It's kind of like, these are the people that were speaking to me when I was growing up and going through some of the same problems. Do you see his music resonating with future generations? 50 years from now, will we still be referencing Aaron Osman's definitive biography and talking about Jason Molina's music?
Yeah, like a Graham Parsons kind of figure. I can see that.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I consider Jason, along with Graham and with Townes Van Zandt and folks like that, like kind of these cult figures that were adored later. I mean, I am glad for the small role that I played in the revitalization of Jason's story. And actually, you know, it was my first book, and all of Jason's friends and family members, they took a risk with me writing this. I'd never written a book before. And so I really wanted to honor their memories and their stories, while at the same time maintain that kind of journalistic point of view and not become too personally involved and certainly not insert myself into the narrative. But yeah, I mean, Jason was a really transformative figure for me. I saw some of myself in him, but also he's the reason that I got into singer-songwriters and a lot of the stuff that I write about today. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, when I found him, I was a punk rock kid. I was listening to loud, fast music, and that's about it. And he really transformed the idea of like what punk rock is to me, and the value of really kind of stripped back, beautiful music.
Yeah. Well, you're gonna draw the link further back with a John Prine book that I know you've been working on for a number of years. When are we going to see your 33 1/3 book on John Prine's debut album?
Yeah, I believe it's going to come out this November, which is really exciting, in tandem with the 50th anniversary of the album. And yeah, it was such an exciting process. I got to talk with John's two living brothers, Billy and Dave. I talked with some of the Memphis Boys who played on the album with John. And it was just a really delightful process researching his life and this period of Chicago as well, the sort of songwriting community, his buddies like Steve Goodman, who really helped foster his career in his early days. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited. It was such an honor and a delight to write this book.
You know, Aaron, it thrills me to hear you talk with such enthusiasm about digging deep, doing research, hundreds of hours of interviews. It's like music journalism's not dead.
Yeah, we're in good. The future's in good hands.
Well, yeah. we are huge fans of your work and your writing, and I'll read anything you write. So, certainly about John Prine. It's gonna be a little funnier.
I'll be lined up at the store to buy that.
I expect a little funnier.
Yeah. We've been talking to Aaron Osman, the author of a terrific biography of Jason Molina, Riding with the Ghost. It came out in 2017, well worth reading, still very relevant. Thanks, Aaron, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That wraps up our talk with Aaron Osman. For our record collecting listeners, the first Songs Ohio album is getting reissued on vinyl in November, if you're interested. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Have you been one of those people telling Greg and me for years that we should cover Jason Molina? Hey, better late than never. Leave us a message now, though, on our website, soundopinions.org. A couple of weeks ago, our beloved associate producer Sol Delgadillo caught up with Leon Bridges for a bonus podcast interview about his latest album, Gold Digger Sound. But what you didn't get to hear in that chat was what track inspired him to begin making music of his own.
Let's hear what Leon had to say about the song that got him hooked on Sonics.
We don't stop, but the time do. Love is in another life, let me remind you. Look back, see me behind you. When it feels good, you don't have to try to. And if you say so, if you say so.
I guess my path of songwriting, there was a moment where I sat down with a friend of mine. I mean, I had just kind of been dabbling in the music thing. I sat down with my friend Dion and I asked him to make a list of some R&B artists who were doing a progressive thing. And one of the guys on that list was Miguel.
Love you like a brother. Treat you like a friend. Respect you like a lover.
I kind of went down the rabbit hole of his music. His song All About You was the song that I kind of gravitated towards the most. And it was just really refreshing to see, you know, this young black dude, because initially he was, you know, playing guitar and doing all that kind of stuff. And it was really inspiring to see that. I think I was like 23. All About You is an example, a perfect example of the beautiful marriage of like soul music, you know, like a timeless, soulful, but still like modern thing. You know, I've always loved like dope musicianship and like jazz music. And like, to me, that's kind of what that song kind of embodied for me initially. You know, there's like this really kind of gritty, smoky, you know, soulful bass line in that song, but it's also juxtaposed with like this more modern, like hip hop style beat. I think those are the, you know, the elements that of that song that really inspired me. Lyrically, it's, you know, hard for me to really speak on exactly what the lyrics mean. And it was an example of just a well-written song. I think during that time, R&B had been lacking just good songwriting, and you know, guys like Miguel and even like Frank Ocean was kind of on the forefront of bringing back good songwriting to R&B music. main premise of R&B is, you know, it's about love and heartbreak and sex, you know, and it's really nice when, you know, that's kind of repackaged in a refreshing way. I felt like that song and Miguel's, I mean, his whole catalog really does that.
That was Leon Bridges with Miguel's All I Want Is You, the song that got him hooked on Sonics.
Great stuff. Great job, Soul. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Jim, I'm very excited. We got Jimmy Jam, man. He's like one of the all-time greats. Minneapolis Funk, the guy who worked with Janet Jackson along with his partner Terry Lewis to make one of the great albums of all time. We're going to talk to him about his long and illustrious career.
And this week on our bonus podcast, we have another interview by another beloved producer. Alex Claiborne talks to Shirley Manson of Garbage. For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our intern, Mary Bernthal. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.